This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Brian Lehr. Today, we thought we'd take the opportunity for a deep dive on someone who so far hasn't been part of the conversation, but is about to become a very visible, very central figure, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts. The Constitution dictates that he is the one to preside over the Senate trial once that gets underway. So it's worth taking a look at Roberts' body of work, his opinions, his background, his philosophy, and his personality to get a sense of what kind of trial he'll eventually end up running in the Senate. But before we get to that, some news that broke this morning from the Associated Press. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she knows, quote, exactly when she'll be transmitting the articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump to the Senate. And lawmakers say the showdown is expected to be resolved this week. So we'll have more on that tomorrow. But now back to the Chief Justice. With me now is the perfect person to parse through all of this, and that's Dahlia Lithwick. She covers courts and the law for Slate, and she hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So what is Chief Justice Roberts actually going to be doing during this impeachment trial, which is going to get underway at some point or another?
It's the question that is the operative question. And unfortunately, we just have two templates. We've only ever had two Senate impeachment trials. And so we don't have a lot of models. We know that in 1868, during the Andrew Johnson impeachment, the Chief Justice was Salmon Chase. Yes, that's his name. And he presided over it very noisily and robustly, and he really inserted himself into the drama. The only other model we have, 1999, the Bill Clinton impeachment, Chief Justice Bill Rehnquist made a point of being almost invisible. He later famously quoted a Gilbert and Sullivan character saying, quote, "I did nothing in particular, and I did it very well." So those are the models. Those are the kind of the two extreme stories that can be told. And then really, we're not even talking about doctrine or law anymore. We're just talking about psychology and personality. Is Chief Justice John Roberts more apt to be a sort of larger-than-life, Chase-like figure, or is he going to be kind of a potted plant in a black robe, more like the model that he saw from Chief Justice Rehnquist? And just parenthetically, even before you get to the psychology of that, it's important to note that he clerked for William Rehnquist. Rehnquist is one of his heroes. And so I think it's fairly safe to say that even if you bracket the way he looks at the world, we know that he very much reveres and adores Rehnquist and is more apt to take that path.
And what else do you know about how he handles himself during normal arguments, oral arguments before the court, to get an indication of how he might handle maybe some sticky partisan situations during an impeachment trial?
Roberts is, and probably the definitive biography, if folks are interested, was written last year by Joan Biskupic, who's covered the court for a long time. And she paints a picture that is very much in line with what I've seen in 20 years of covering the court, which is he is a very modest, quiet guy. He is the winning guy that we remember from his confirmation hearings, you know, just a very affable, warm, kind of twinkly, blue-eyed guy. He's going to be 65. Very soon. So he's actually relatively young for a chief justice. And this is a person who grew up in Indiana, very much a Midwestern, reserved, careful, not a bomb thrower, never wanting to be the center of attention. And I think maybe the best way to think about how he's going to conduct an impeachment trial that he, I would say, very reluctantly will preside over is that he's going to have to try to find the balance between his own natural tendency to fade into the background, to be an institutional player, to not hog the spotlight, against what I think is an equally compelling imperative for him, which is to protect the courts, to protect the institution and the dignity and the sense of historic nonpartisanship of the courts. And those two imperatives, particularly in a polarized impeachment, are going to somewhat clash with one another.
I heard you discuss this on your podcast, Amicus, and you described him as an institutionalist, and that's the way he operates on the court now. I mean, that struggle exists, whether he is adheres to his conservative upbringing or he preserves which sometimes can be in conflict with what he sees as his role as Chief Justice, preserving that, you know, institution of the Supreme Court.
A good way to think about Roberts is, I think there's no disputing that he is one of the most conservative jurists we have seen on the Supreme Court in decades. There consistently are these studies that are done. He's always sort of in the top six or seven most conservative justices that we've seen since the New Deal. So let's be super clear that nobody thinks this is a country club Republican in the style of Sandra Day O'Connor, or even, I think, a country club Reagan Republican in the style of Anthony Kennedy. This is a very conservative man. The reason he is now the swing justice to the extent that he is because the court has really polarized around him. And so for the first time in my lifetime, we have four pretty dyed-in-the-wool conservative jurists to his right, four liberal moderates to his left, and he finds himself in the center. And that's a very improbable role for the person I've just described as a lifelong conservative. But I think if you think about the handful of times in his career that he has defected from his own political instincts and voted with the left wing of the court, you'll find that it's in the two Affordable Care Act cases. It was in last year's census case when they wanted to put a citizenship question on the census. In those cases, he defects away from the right wing of the court, almost always, exactly to your point, to preserve the institution of the court, to preserve the sense that the court transcends politics. And so that's the seam on which John Roberts is to be sort of watched in the coming weeks and months. How does he balance what I think are his natural impulses, which are very conservative Federalist Society impulses, against his burning need to rise above this, to not himself be seen as a partisan political actor, and to not allow the court to be seen as a partisan political institution?
Just a brief civics review. We haven't done this impeachment thing in 20 years. The Constitution says that the Chief Justice has two main jobs, right? I mean, he presides over the Supreme Court, and then the other duty is to preside over any impeachment trials. That's it, right? It's according to the Constitution?
Yeah, and it's important to point out, I think people sometimes think that on the Supreme Court he has extra power. He has no extra power. He is one of nine justices. It's almost entirely kind of formal and ministerial. So even presiding over the Supreme Court doesn't mean he has a thumb on the scale. To the extent that the Chief Justice has extra superpowers at the Supreme Court, he can assign opinions when he's in the majority, and that, for complicated reasons, can become a real power. But really, no, he just does a lot of boring admin stuff on the Supreme Court. And then in this very rare occasion, this will be the third in history, he will, in the mornings, preside over the U.S. Supreme Court and then cross the street in the afternoons and preside over an impeachment trial. But interestingly, it's also almost purely ceremonial at the Supreme Court. And one of the things that's most interesting is trying to parse, again, with very little data, we only have two impeachment trials to go off, how much actual power he will have in an impeachment trial in the Senate, and how much is just, again, him being a potted plant. And that's the thing that the con law scholars are screaming and setting themselves on fire about right now.
Yeah. And so what could he be deciding? I mean, what's going to come? What kind of questions might come up where he'll have to act as a referee?
It's so interesting because if you look at, you know, the Constitution itself, it says the Senate, quote, shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. That sounds like big thumb on the scale for the Senate, except the Senate rules that have been in existence for a long time say that the Chief Justice, as the presiding officer, quote, shall have the power to make and issue orders. So already, right, there's a conflict. Who has the sole power? I think that it's probably been stipulated in the constitutional law world that the fact that the vice president is not presiding, the fact that they pull in the Chief Justice and say he has some role in presiding, and that's the word they use, suggests that he has to have some kind of affirmative duties, that this isn't just him sitting there looking good on television. So I think that the real question is, you know, if the the Senate rules provide that he will, quote, rule on all questions of evidence, which is what they provide, and that includes, quote, relevance and materiality, then presumably he's issuing actual rulings. He is able to make rulings about evidence, about calling witnesses, which we already know is going to be a sticky wicket. So all of this is a little bit up in the air, only because the rules provide that the Senate can always override him.
With a majority
with
vote?
With a simple majority.
Which the Republicans have.
Which the Republicans have. So this is a very, very sort of almost ephemeral power he has to issue all sorts of rulings. Not only can they, by a simple majority, override him, but he can also himself punt. He can simply say, I'm going to send this back, this question, and let the Senate decide by a simple majority. So he doesn't even have to engage in the ugly optics of having made a ruling and getting overridden. He can also just take the kind of easy out, which is, you know what, let's let the Senate decide. So really, again, right on that seam of how much he wants to seize power, if he wants to be in a battle of sort of political or even optics will with the Senate, he can very, very much make decisions about, I think John Bolton should testify, and then force the Senate to overrule him, which will look terrible. Or he can just kind of punt over and over again and say, I'm really just here to get through it.
Did Chief Justice Rehnquist, when he was presiding over the Clinton impeachment trial, did he kick these sorts of questions back to the Senate?
I think he really did do as little as he had to do. Although I will say the one big material difference between what Roberts is about to wade into and what John Roberts, Chief Justice Rehnquist had, is that the Senate fixed the rules in advance, very detailed rules. And they did that, and this is important, by a consensus between the Republicans and the Democrats. So it was clear going in, everybody had already done all the brokering, what the rules were going to be, including the rule that we're now relitigating about we're going to wait and determine a little bit later on whether to call witnesses. But that was brokered in a bipartisan way. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these issues don't become problematic for Chief Justice Rehnquist because everybody has stipulated to them. It's problematic for John Roberts if, by a simple majority, without doing a deal with Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell says, these are the rules. We'll decide later whether we're calling witnesses. Now we've decided not to call witnesses. Now this is not, the appearance is not of a bipartisan agreement to a set of rules. It's that Mitch McConnell kind of by fiat decided how this was going to go. That puts Roberts in a very, very different posture than Chief Justice Rehnquist was in.
Well, fortunately, this isn't a partisan situation in Washington. I'm sure everything will go
very
smoothly.
It's going to work out
swimmingly. Figure it out.
Not to worry at all.
Alan from Brooklyn. Alan, are you there?
Yeah, good morning, thanks. Fascinating discussion. Just wondering, since Roberts just made his annual report about the federal courts, in which he stressed the importance of civics education, I'm wondering how much, either in ruling on evidence or in just speaking in an educational capacity, he might have the power to remind the public of the significance of separation of powers to keeping our democracy from sliding into a one-party.
We lost Alan there, but did you get...
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and I'm so glad he asked it. On New Year's Eve, literally right before the ball drops, the Chief Justice always issues this annual State of the Judiciary report. And Alan is completely right to say that this was a very unusual report for the Chief Justice. Often they talk about judicial vacancy or judicial pay raises. He just, again, that sort of boring anodyne admin stuff that he does. This year, no way. This was a full-on discursion of the Federalist Papers and John Jay and what happens when mob rule over masters, sort of the calmer reasoning minds. And it was very much a love song to civics and civics education. He talked a lot about how misunderstood the judiciary was, and that was a little bit of a callback, you may remember, to the one fight, the overt fight he's had with Donald Trump, who would say, oh, oh, these are bad Obama judges and these are good Trump judges. And the only time that John Roberts has pushed back on a pretty relentless campaign by Donald Trump to discredit judges who rule against him was last year when he painstakingly said, there's no such thing as an Obama judge or a Bush judge or a Trump judge. And he kind of pulled on that thread as part of his State of the Judiciary and talked about how, look, the judicial branch relies on public trust and understanding. It has neither the purse nor the sword. It has no army to enforce its wishes. The judiciary really requires that people trust the judiciary. And he talked a lot about how important it was that Brown v. Board of Education, famously desegregating the public schools, was written in a manner that it could be printed in full in the newspapers, the judiciary making itself transparent. So I think Alan's point is a really good one, that this entire State of the Judiciary, worth reading, 7 pages, was in a sense a love song to checks and balances, right? That we have to abide, even though mobs may lead us astray, by certain notions of the rule of law. At the same time, he certainly didn't say anything that signaled how he was going to perform in the hearing. And I think it's very easy to suggest that what he was doing is sort of doing an infomercial, a little Schoolhouse Rock miniseries on how important an independent judiciary is, precisely so that he can do nothing whatsoever at the Senate trial. So it's tough to read what he was signaling. Whatever it was subtle. And the coda to the subtlety is that he mentioned in his State of Judiciary, there's an amazing federal judge. He's the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit. He goes out into the schools and reads with underprivileged children. He didn't name him, but that judge was Merrick Garland.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
We have a question from Twitter, and this goes to what Chief Justice, how he might act on the in this role. David Kramer on Twitter asked, at what point does a senator get to ask for a motion of dismissal? Is there a chance that McConnell plans to throw this out within minutes of the start of the impeachment trial?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that the answer is, again, they're very thin rules. It is certainly possible. And McConnell said, you may recall, before he said we would have a full Senate trial, he said we might make this go away in the first day. And he walked that back over the course of the fall and later suggested, no, we want to have a full and robust trial. I'm not sure exactly when the tick-tock is that somebody could ask for the entire thing to be dismissed, but it certainly seems to me that Mitch McConnell has made plain in the last few weeks when he said, I'm completely coordinating my strategy with the White House. There will be no light between what they want and what I want. Lindsey Graham has said the same, that Mitch McConnell is, I think, sort of building an on-ramp to making this happen as quickly as possible. No witnesses. So I think that what McConnell is looking to do right now, and the latest framing that I've heard, is that there will be a sort of opening presentations. We'll have, they're called managers, right? House members who come over and sort of prosecute.
These are congressmen and congresswomen who would be prosecuting,
who prosecute the case, and they're called the impeachment managers. He will let them make their statements, but he will allow for no witnesses. The way the rules work is the senators don't get to grandstand. They actually have to write their questions out, and the Chief Justice reads them, but they also have to have their butts in the chair. They have to be there. So it's a really different moment for senators who are used to getting up and filibustering for hours. They're going to have to sit and listen. But I think that if the question is, can Mitch McConnell essentially make this almost completely vaporous and non-existent? I think not only can he, but that's the game plan. It's a little bit, by the way, in tension with what the White House wants.
Sure.
Because Donald Trump wants nothing more than to call Hunter Biden and, you know, the Steele dossier and Alexandra Chalupa and everybody in the quote-unquote Ukraine scandal. I think if Donald Trump had his way, we'd have John Solomon, you know, from The Hill, and Rudy Giuliani and circus fire throwers and the whole thing. And so one of the things McConnell has to navigate is how crazy to let this become.
Yeah, not make it a reality television show.
That's what the president, I think, wants.
We have a question from Frank in Little Ferry, New Jersey. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, hi there. How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
Great job.
Appreciate it.
I agree with everything the guest has said. My question, though, is she just recently said that the Chief Justice gave an order, say, that witnesses can be called or should be called. That's what it should be. That witnesses should be called, that the Senate could override that with a simple majority. And that I all understand. But to me, it's that the Chief Justice can't make an order that's going to be held. How is he presiding at all over the procedure, which I don't think, adversely what everybody else is saying, is not supposed to be a political process. And that's the Chief Justice's main mm-hmm. thing that he has to do,
right,
is to make sure that it's nonpartisan.
Thank you, Frank.
It's such a good question, Frank, and it goes to, right, in any other legal procedure, a judge would 100 times a day make determinations about witnesses and admissibility and evidence, and the jury would not get to override that, right? You can't have the jury leap up and say, no, by a simple majority, we just don't want to hear from that witness. And so you're right. It's sort of anathema to what we think of as both a kind of judicial process and what we think of as a meaningful check, right? How can the Chief Justice be a check on the Senate if the Senate gets to say, nah, we just don't like that ruling and we're going to override it? And I think it goes to the kind of thing that was embedded in your question, which is this is not a purely legal process. This is a legal and political process. It is both. And it lives in this weird interstitial place between what is pure law, what sounds, you're exactly right to posit it the way you do, because that is what a trial would do and that is what a judge would do. This is something different. It is a quasi-political process. And so these questions that are really important questions about the sort of limits and the contours of the Chief Justice's authority all go to the framers trying to split the difference between what was going to be a trial that looked like a trial that appeared to have certain presumptions of legality that are also overmastered by the political bodies. And I have no satisfactory answer to you because it's really a puzzler, but it is very, very clear that both the framers in the Constitution and later the Senate rules as laid out around the time of the Johnson impeachment try to live with that ambiguity while not resolving it in any way that makes it clear that this is a legal judicial process at the end. It is both, and that kind of sucks for people who would like to believe that John Roberts can make this, by his own steam, an entirely legal judicial process.
Right. Mark in Manhattan has a question about another hypothetical scenario. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I want to thank Dahlia. It's very informative, very interesting. But I do have a question I'm confused about. I keep hearing that the Democrats need to convince 4 Republican senators to vote to have witnesses to get 51 votes. But if they convince 3 GOP senators to vote with them, it would be a 50-50 tie. And wouldn't Justice Roberts then break the tie, in which case they only need to convince 3 Republican senators to switch?
That's a great question. I'm actually not sure of the math, and part of me almost worriedly says that the tiebreaker wouldn't become John Roberts, it becomes Mike Pence, right? Who is, I think, still the tiebreaking entity, although I'm not sure if he disappears out of the Senate process. But I think you're quite right that I think the idea that if you could just logjam it so that John Roberts had to make the final vote, whether or not he was sort of making the vote as the tying entity in the Senate, that he could, if you could get it to 50-50, he could kind of empower himself. Again, I think the problem with the logic is that John Roberts doesn't want to do anything of the sort. I think that John Roberts is going to do every single thing he can to avoid deciding. And I'm not sure what's going to happen if you get to a place where there's stalemate in both the Senate and a Chief Justice who doesn't want to act. At some point, somebody's got to kind of put on the big boy pants in this scenario. And it's a really, really good question technically. But I can tell you that John Roberts does not want, and this is worth saying, we haven't said it up top, but John Roberts is presiding over the biggest Supreme Court term I've seen in my lifetime, plus a pair of financial records cases about Donald Trump that are going to be heard in March. The last thing John Roberts wants to do, in addition to all that, in an election year, is put himself in the middle of this impeachment process.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. And it's interesting what you said. If Pence is the deciding vote, he could literally vote to remove the president from office and then become president.
I may be making this up. We're going to have to check. Wow. But I have. It's such a good question. I haven't thought about it. Yep.
Storyline. I'm going to interject fact check from NPR. Apparently, a 50-50 tie is considered a failure to pass because Vice President Pence cannot deciding vote.
Well, that is your House of Cards scenario. Good. Thank you, NPR.
So if the trial, and this I have a self-interest here, I'm actually going to the Supreme Court on Tuesday to cover the Bridgegate case, which there's oral arguments on Bridgegate. What happens? Justice Roberts will go from the Supreme Court presiding over the normal oral arguments and then go down the block to handle the impeachment trial?
Yeah, that's what he does. He just crosses the street and goes into the Senate, and he's got a very busy day. He does the morning, and then he does the afternoon. And again, worth pointing out, John Roberts does not give big public speeches. John Roberts, unlike his predecessor, Bill Rehnquist, never affixed gold bars to his black robes. This is not a person who wants to be noticed or recognized, and he is going to now have a very, very public face.
So he won't have a special robe like Rehnquist had?
Very dubious that he goes for the gold bars. That was a Gilbert and Sullivan affectation. This is the opposite of the Gilbert and Sullivan Chief Justice.
Dahlia Lithwick covers courts and the law for Slate and hosts their great Amicus podcast. Dahlia, thank you so much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, if you have impeachment questions, you can call them in and leave a voicemail. You might get to hear it on the show and get an answer from our guests. Call, leave a message. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from WNYC's live daily news talk show, The Brian Lehrer Show, which we also encourage you to listen to every day from 10 a.m. to noon. You can stream it live at WNYC.org. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Brian. Thanks for listening. And as always, we'll have more tomorrow.